As you've heard us say, that soothing tone, Clouds Below Your Knees, is brought to us by the amazing Ray Lynch, and it is signals that it is Wednesday, 8 p.m., and time for So What's Your Story? We are the only program originating in Houston, Texas, devoted entirely to storytelling, right here on listener-sponsored KPFT 90.1 FM Houston. I'm Greg Audell, and along with our team, co-hosts Mary Edgerton, Warren Holloman, Hank Rubicek, engineer Nicole Rocherlin, production intern extraordinaire Titania Gago, and last but certainly not least, Floyd the Wonder Dog, who is asleep in my lap, I co-host this amazing little program, and I am privileged to be your guide through some moving stories tonight by someone who seems like a friend to me and thousands of others because we often eat lunch with him every single day as he co-hosts Channel 2's Houston Life, along with Courtney Zavala, every weekday afternoon at 1 p.m., He's Houston Life co-host Derek Shore. He is a three-time Emmy Award-winning reporter and producer. Three times, huh?
Yeah.
That's impressive.
Three.
Spending most of his career in Los Angeles, he reported for a weekly news magazine. And since his first reporting job in 1998, must have started when he was 10, Derek has appeared on each of the three major networks, Channel One News, Current TV, and several TV dramas and feature films. I want to hear more about those. Now, this is really cool. He's the first television journalist to travel to the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean to see the wreckage of the Titanic. Who gets to do that? That is amazing. And the youngest to fly in an F-16 fighter jet with the U.S. Air Force Thunderbirds. Moreover, he reported for the WB television special, The Day It All Changed, an expose about the terrorist attacks on September 11th. His assignments have taken him from Skid Row to the red carpet, to the White House, and to every continent covering breaking stories. He's a native of Salt Lake City, graduated from UCLA with a bachelor's degree in cultural studies, lives in Houston with his partner, Brandon Baroque, and Derek Shore, welcome to So What's Your Story?
Craig, thank you so much. This is an honor, really. I love being here so far, and your dog, Floyd, is adorable.
Thank you. Yeah, I can't do the show without Floyd. No, I appreciate it because I really do watch your show. My mom was a local newspaper reporter in the suburbs, and I realize, you know, the local reporters are the ones that know the heartbeat of the community, and that's, you know, one thing I really love about your show. You might be talking about opera or the dog park or a new restaurant, and there just aren't many places where you can get such a flavor of the city.
Thank you. That's a huge compliment. I mean, that's exactly what we try to do. The name of the show is Houston Life, and we try to show all of the great things to do in Houston, and we also try to highlight some of the unexpected places and people and things to do around town.
You pack an amazing amount into an hour.
Yeah, you know, our producers, they work so hard. We have a small team, but we work hard.
Well, I was saying it was funny. I was fortunate to be there a few weeks ago, and there were some serious interviews, there were some food segments, and there was goat yoga. So, you know, Derek had to transition from all these interviews and then had goats placed on top of him. And,
oh, my gosh. The wardrobe changes, that's the challenge, because our commercial breaks are usually 2 minutes. Sometimes they're only 1 minute. So, you know, ripping off the slacks and the tie and putting on gym shorts,
I can imagine.
It's not pretty.
I hope you get it right every time.
You know what? With microphones and the little earpiece that we wear, the IFB, that makes a wardrobe change even more complicated because there's more to take off. So
yeah.
If you saw any streaking backstage, I apologize now.
Well, can't they just CGI your clothes?
You know what? I will ask that.
I think that would save a lot.
That's
of
a
time.
Great recommendation.
I'm genuinely in awe of your accomplishments. And if we have time, I'm going to ask you about them one by one. But the common denominator in your career, it seems to me, is storytelling. What do you want your stories to communicate to your audience? Is that something you think about?
You know, I can't say that I consciously think about that. I think maybe it is. It's clearly part of what I do. I certainly, storyteller, you hit the nail on the head. That is exactly what I consider myself first and foremost. And I think what we try to convey on the show and what I try to convey in the work that I do here as well as in my past life in other cities doing my work, relatability, realness, authenticity, every single person out there. I mean, your show is about storytelling, right?
Yes.
And everybody out there, if you watch the Today Show, Kathy Lee Gifford has a song, Everyone Has a Story. And it is so true because I've covered the Oscars multiple times. I've covered the Super Bowl. I've interviewed celebrities and the First Lady and all kinds of folks, right? These notable folks. And honestly, no offense to all of those people, I kind of get bored with that. The stories that I find the most fascinating are real people. The single mom living in the suburbs, working two jobs, trying to make ends meet. The homeless person living in Midtown. Those, to me, are the stories that really have stayed with me throughout my career. So to make a long answer even longer, Greg, I would just say we all have a story, and the fact that I can shed light on someone's story who's not a celebrity, honestly, sincerely, that is the most satisfying part of my job.
And that's one of the goals of our program is, you know, we want people to find the storyteller within themselves and realize they are a storyteller. You know, when I was 13 or so, I wrote a newspaper column and I interviewed celebrities. And
at 13?
Yes.
All right.
And a woman named Lucy Germany, who has passed on, was editor of the Episcopalian State newspaper. And she told me, she said, all these celebrities, you know, they're interesting. But if you know the right questions to ask, so is the mailman, so is the waitress. It just depends on how good of an interviewer you are.
Absolutely.
And I was like, wow, that was a lightning bolt moment for me.
It really is. And, you know, I really credit my mother. Today is actually my mom's birthday. She's amazing.
Can you give her a shout out?
Yeah, and today on the show, yeah.
Well,
thank you. Thank you for watching the show. My mom was raised in a small town in southern Utah, population 2,000. For a time, she lived in New York City. She's a devout Mormon. She lives in Salt Lake City, where I grew up. Single mom. She raised my sisters and me. And my mom, honestly, she's the type of person who runs into someone at the grocery store and strikes up a conversation, end up hugging them. It's almost like she's run into a lifelong friend.
So the apple didn't fall far from the tree.
Oh my gosh, Greg. It is so funny. The older I get, the more I realize I am a carbon copy of my mother. And we have some very spirited conversations. And I truly do credit my career with my mom, because wow. I think it is. You know, my mom is the type of person, and here in Houston, I'm sure a lot of the listeners can relate to this. You walk down the street, sometimes you pass someone, they don't even look at you. They don't even acknowledge another human is there.
Believe me, Floyd notices if people don't pay attention
to him.
Dude,
Floyd is a little lover. He's adorable. And I just feel like it comes naturally to me. When someone's passing me on the street, I look at them.
Right.
I make eye contact. I smile and say hello. That is what my mom told me, and I think a little bit of that goes a long way. I wish we all could be like my mom.
Amen. I think you're a natural fit to Houston.
Thank you, Greg.
It sounds like, you know, the road from Salt Lake City to the studio has been complicated, arduous, and interesting. And I'm thinking your first story will illustrate that. Would you share it with us?
Absolutely. Yeah. So growing up in Salt Lake City, the population now in the Salt Lake Valley, I think, is pushing about 2 million. But, you know, Salt Lake, the city itself is about 30% Mormon, 70% non-Mormon. When you look at the rest of the state, Utah, it's exactly opposite. It's about 70% Mormon, 30% non-Mormon. And growing up, we lived in the suburbs. We lived back in the trees. We had a little creek running down the side of our yard. I think we paid like $5 for the house. You know, it was back in the time when things were affordable. And growing up, it was my mom, my two sisters, and me. My dad was around. I don't have a lot of memory of him. He left when I was about 4. He was barred from the New York Stock Exchange for fraud. He was arrested and jailed for beating my mother. And he was well-respected and loved in our Mormon community because he was tall, he was good-looking, and he was a Mormon guy. So, of course, he was the good one. Back in the 80s, when my mom was a single woman, the only divorcee in the neighborhood, people blamed my mother and assumed that she was single because she was a difficult woman. So already we were sort of outcasts because we were different. Our family structure looked different. And the church, I know there are a lot of Mormons in Houston, by the way. Some I went to high school with in Salt Lake actually have moved to Houston. The structure of the church is really all about the nuclear family, the husband, the wife, the children. It's this very idyllic scenario, right? Now that I'm 36 years old and I've traveled all over the world and I've done all kinds of stories, I know that that's not really what a lot of families look like. There are a lot of people out there who have no parents. They're orphans. Look at the Parkland, Florida shooter.
Right.
There are a lot of people raised by single parents, single dads, single moms. And they're blended families of all types, right? But this was not the image of a family that I grew up with in Salt Lake City. So that was strike one. We knew that we were different. We would walk to church on Sunday mornings, and my mom, my two sisters, me, we'd walk to church, and we would see my father's truck in the driveway of a woman who lived down the street because he had spent the night there the night before. It was pretty intense. So then as I got a little bit older, the neighbor guys were playing football. I was interested in hanging up fabric in my mom's living room and entryway and putting on plays. I wanted to be a magician. That was my life goal, to be a magician. And as the neighbor boys started playing football and doing sports, I found myself playing the piano to accompany the choir. Things really started getting a little more intense when I got to junior high and I realized, holy cow, I am different. I mean, if you're wondering whether you are different as a young person, trust me, your peers will tell you you are different. They'll tell you with the slurs they throw at you, with their body language. This still happens today. Every once in a while, I hear people say, oh, you know, you young people, you have it so easy. Growing up gay these days is so easy. And I actually take deep offense to that. I'm 36. I'm not that young anymore. But it's hard to be gay no matter what age you are, right? And going to school and being called faggot, I hate that word, by the way. I'm sorry I just said it, but it's part of the vernacular, right? People still use that word. That was something that I faced every single day at school. It was not cool to wear a cardigan sweater, and I wore glasses, and I played the piano. I was not like the boys running down the field. I was athletic. I had natural ability. I played volleyball. But even that was considered a, quote, gay sport, right? So school was not my friend. And even my friends at school were not really my friends, most of them. And every day I spent trying to fly under the radar. That was my goal. I would wake up. I would feel sick to my stomach. I would be nervous. Sometimes I would cry before going to school. But I went to seventh grade. It's a long story, but that year my family, we were also homeless. We were living in my neighbor's bedroom. One bedroom, the four of us. It's a long story for another show, Greg. But there were a lot of pressures going on, and it really was little Derek, little seventh grade, 13-year-old Derek, trying to get through the day. And what's interesting, to fast forward and see the life that I have now, no, I never would have thought I would host a TV show. I never would have thought I would win a handful of Emmys. I never would have thought that I would be sort of fearless in sharing my opinion or talking about the fact that Brandon is an amazing guy and I can't wait to spend my life with him. But back then, none of that really calculated. I really was all of the talents that I had, playing the piano and singing and being creative. Those were things that I felt sort of ashamed of and like I needed to hide. And while I did feel I could be myself at home, I could, you know, pretend I could fly. I jumped off the roof once with an umbrella because I wanted to be like Mary Poppins, my idol. It didn't work out. I fell to the ground. No broken bones, though. I'm okay. Just emotional scars. Those were my safe spaces, being at home. My sisters maybe thought I was a little kooky, but my mom totally accepted me. School, however, was not so fun. And I'm going to wrap up this story by sharing one last little anecdote, which was the fact that this continued through junior high school. One day in ninth grade, after sixth period class, I will never forget this day, this girl named Brandy Miller, she walked up to me and handed me a piece of paper. And on the paper, it said, it was like a petition, sort of. It said at the top of the paper, "These are all the people in Mr. Brown's sixth period science class who think Derek Shore is gay."
Wow.
And the entire class had signed it. So those memories are seared into my brain, and I don't think about them. I really don't. I mean, I'm glad we're talking about them now, because I do think it's important to remember where we all came from. But growing up is tough, and for me, it just reaffirms the fact that we all have differences, we all feel pain, we all feel insecurity, and I hope that in some way there's something that I can do in my life, professionally, personally, or otherwise, to help the young people out there feel not as alone as I did. It's tough to be young.
Well, I'm glad that's the lesson you took from it, and it didn't just embitter you against all humanity.
Yeah.
You know, there's so much to process in your story. I want to go back in time and give a hug and let him know who he's going to turn out to be and say, man, you got a great life ahead of you, kid. And it does make me think of the It Gets Better campaign.
Yeah, it does. There, when you look at the suicide rate, Greg, this is, I just think it's unacceptable. Salt Lake City, as idyllic a place as people view it as, there's a major issue. When everyone around you is Mormon and white and you're expected to conform to these standards, there are reasons why Salt Lake has a really high suicide rate,
wow,
a really high opioid abuse rate. And those are things. I'm a fan of bringing information to the table and facts. And the one thing I do realize growing up in the sheltered way that I did, I didn't really develop critical thinking skills. You're sort of taught that if you're different, that's bad. And now I live my life every single day being proud of the fact that I'm a little different and doing what I can to help other people who are different thrive.
Did you ever buy into the narrative that you were being fed by these kids, that you were defective in some way or there was something wrong with you?
Oh, my gosh. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Back in the 80s and 90s when I was growing up in Salt Lake City, the term homosexuality was used all the time. It was never really gay people or, oh, you know, so-and-so, Uncle Dean. I had a gay uncle. Never even really knew him because we didn't talk about the homo.
Right.
You know, we would whisper the word, oh, he's a homo. And you really are taught, I was taught anyway, I can't speak for everyone, but I certainly was taught that being gay was the same as being, you would always, homosexuals, that term, that was always used in the same sentence or paragraph with rapists and murderers and all of these other big, quote, sins of the world. So, holy cow, Greg. I mean, it was loud and clear, being gay, not okay.
One of the most horrifying things I have ever seen on television, though I actually saw it on YouTube, was by someone who was so kind to me as a kid, I have to say that, but a special by Mike Wallace in 1968 called The Homosexuals. It was the most horrifying thing you've ever seen about how they're infiltrating your schools, and you may not know it, but they could be teaching your kids.
Oh,
they could
gosh.
Be working in your office. And it tells you how far we have come, though there's still far to go.
How far many of us have come, though, Greg, because that was 1968, you said?
Right.
There are people right here in Houston. In fact, I was just online reading today. There are people who have been leading this anti-gay campaign, doctors and notable people
right.
in the community who have money to mobilize and put out this propaganda saying, oh, you know, the gays, if gay marriage is legal, this was a few years ago, of course, then kindergartners, they're going to be learning about sodomy and anal sex.
Right,
are you kidding
me?
And these are people, by the way, because of my position and because of my role on TV, I have to shake hands with people like this.
Right.
And you know what?
I've actually seen that a couple of times.
Yeah.
I know exactly what you're talking about.
And it's shocking. But but here's the thing. I try to live my life with grace and dignity and being classy. And something, again, my mom, I know we talked about her tonight, she's always taught me to be nice to people. I can be nice and respectful to other people. And at the end of the day, this is what I've realized. I used to so desperately want people like, you know, these bigoted folks in the community who think that gay people are destroying the world. I used to want their approval. I used to seek their approval. I used to hope members of Congress would actually support me. And something happened along the way, maybe over the past few years, where I realized, you know what, folks, don't support gay rights because of me. I don't need your support. I really don't. I'm happy. I've got nieces, nephews, a loving mother, sisters, a great boyfriend who will eventually be my husband. My life is totally fine. These bigoted folks who don't support gay rights and equality, they need to support gay rights for themselves.
Yeah.
Because in my mind, they are so backwards. And I actually feel pity. I genuinely, sincerely, Greg, feel pity for folks like this who have made comments like, oh, well, kindergartners are going to learn about anal sex. I'm sorry. What planet are you living on? No,
right.
Nobody actually thinks that unless they are extremely out of touch.
Right. And choose their sources of news very, very carefully.
Right.
I'll tell you what, let's move on to a lighter note, because sure. I think everyone is fascinated about the idea of running off to Hollywood. I know, yeah. I grew up thinking about it. I mean, everyone thinks about going off to Hollywood, becoming a star, being on the red carpet, but not many people really do it. Would you tell us about how you did just that?
Yeah, absolutely. So when I was younger, I already mentioned that I really wanted to be a magician. Super cool career choice, right? Or maybe a little creepy, depending on some magicians we've seen. So the irony of this story is that even though I'm no longer a member of the Mormon Church, clearly, I'm not welcome. You know, gays are not exactly welcome in the Mormon Church. But the church was actually sort of the beginning of my television career, because I remember sitting in church one Sunday and they announced from the pulpit that the church was shooting a new full-length feature film. You know, the church has a lot of money. They've got serious budgets for full-length feature films about the, you know, their version of history, right? The early days of the church. So the church was looking for extras in an upcoming film. I was 12 years old at the time. And of course, the moment that church meeting got out, I hounded my mom. Mom, we have to do this. We have to do this. We have to do this. Well, essentially, over the next few years, I was an extra in a few movies that were being shot in Salt Lake City, because at the time, Salt Lake actually had a pretty thriving film market. The tax credits were good, and in Utah, you've got the desert, the mountains, lakes. There's a lot of different diverse landscape. So fast forward to me being 15 years old. I had started auditioning. I actually was at the point where I was auditioning for speaking roles, which for me was a big deal, because at 15, I was like, I'm tired of being an extra. This sucks. You just sit around all day. And I wanted to speak. I wanted an actual speaking role. I had been faxing the Utah Film Commission my sad, pathetic resume. Like, hey, I've been in 3 school plays. Why don't you hire me as an actor for your movie coming to town? And by some miracle, at 15 years old, I was cast in a CBS primetime drama called Promised Land. This show was a spinoff of the show Touched by an Angel, starring Della Reese and Roma Downey. That show was shot in Salt Lake. I think that show ran for about 9 seasons.
It's still on every night.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, it is still a program that is in reruns. Promised Land is in still reruns, by the way. I still get residuals from that. Yeah. So I know that's why I was like, holy cow, actors make so much money. And at 15 years old, this was still a time in my life when school had not really gotten much easier. And when I was cast in this role on Promised Land, the actress Julia Stiles, who was also 15 years old at the time, she was playing my ex-girlfriend in the series. And honestly, it was sort of like everything changed overnight, yet it didn't change. You know, I missed like a week of school, and as a 15-year-old, I think that first episode paid, I mean, it was a few $1,000s. That was a lot of money.
Nice.
And I was my summer job was teaching swimming lessons at the swimming pool, making a huge salary of $7.50 per hour, way more than minimum wage, because at the time, minimum wage, I think, was $4.25.
Wow.
So I thought I was doing well at $7.50 an hour. I started acting, and suddenly, holy cow, this was real money. And essentially, over the next few years, my sophomore, junior, and senior year in high school, that work sort of continued. So I continued booking speaking roles. I did a couple feature films, a couple Disney Channel movies. I was in a movie called Drive Me Crazy with Melissa Joan Hart and Adrienne Grenier. And the magic of being on a movie set and the lights, camera, action element, my mom was coming with me. My mom actually became really jazzed about it because, you know, it's exciting.
Yeah, nice.
Your son is doing well. He's got his own trailer. And don't get me wrong, it's not like I was living this high-rolling Hollywood life. I still went to high school in Salt Lake City. I did the school plays. I bought this chunky little car that was very old and used and a stick shift, and I got around. So it wasn't like suddenly I was living the high life. But this is, when I say my life changed overnight, I don't mean because of money or material things. What I mean is I suddenly had this window outside of Salt Lake City You know, I was sitting in the makeup and hair trailer getting ready for scenes in the morning, and I was working with crew members who were from L.A. and New York and Sydney and London and all of these interesting cities around the world that I had never been to. I mean, I had barely been outside the state of Utah. And I remember sitting and getting ready for scenes, and these people would say, "So, Derek, have you ever, I don't know, thought about leaving Salt Lake City?" I think what they saw was that I was this young gay dude who needed like a bit of exposure and getting out. And fast forward, I got a reporting job at the local CBS station in Salt Lake. I ended up moving to LA a month after graduating high school and working for Channel One News, which is the high school news channel. Right. I grew up watching Channel One. It was Anderson Cooper.
Lisa Ling.
Lisa Ling, yes. Lisa Ling, who I'm still friends with, and her little sister Laura Ling, and all of these people who really shaped a lot of my middle school and high school years, because these reporters, I would see them traveling around the world to Sarajevo and Chernobyl and all of these places that honestly I had never heard of until Channel One News. So the fact that I became a Channel One reporter honestly was kind of like a dream come true. It derailed my acting career, which was not actually a career. But honestly, even though I'm not religious or spiritual, I believe that moving into this world of journalism and storytelling, Greg, it was the best thing that could have ever happened to me, because this guy from Utah who was raised in this bubble, suddenly, I mean, I've been to 6 of the 7 continents.
Wow.
Antarctica is the only one I have left. And around the world, I mean, I've covered stories about poverty and neglect and women's rights and human rights, excuse me, and endangered species, elephants and great apes in Africa. I covered SARS in China. The 60th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz, the 10-year anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall, these amazing events in history. And for me, it's not only been a great education, but it has just solidified this feeling in my core that we are all different. We all share the same planet. We all have stories to tell. And you know what? There is no skin color or religion or group of people that's better than the other. I have spent my entire career trying to unlearn what I learned growing up.
Wow, what a great lesson.
Yeah, and so that's sort of the 7-minute version of my road to Hollywood, which did include like the Oscars and all of that too.
Please tell me you're working on a book, because you're the best thing I can say about a good story is that I am compelled to hear more. And you leave me just with so many questions, and that is a great story.
Thank you. Well, I appreciate that. The thing about my job is that every day when I host this show on Channel 2, we are interviewing people from all over Houston with all different types of backgrounds. So I've got to be honest, Greg, it's different for me to have this role reversal and actually talk about my own story, because usually my days are so crazy. They start early. They end late. There's not a whole lot of time to reflect upon my own life and the successes and the failures, because trust me, there have been a lot of failures. But it is kind of nice to step back once in a while and say, hey, you know what? I worked my tail off, and there have been some memorable successes along the way, and absolutely, I will always cherish those.
Well, you know, Jacqueline Kennedy said that she never wrote her memoirs because she was too busy living her life.
Oh my gosh, that is a great quote. That is a great quote.
You know, I spend a lot of time speaking to young people, and I'm on the board of a drop-in center for homeless teenagers in Montrose called the Pink Giraffe House.
Yeah.
And one thing we're always telling young people is that truly, if you dream it, and if you're willing to work hard for it, and, you know, if you stick to it, you can achieve it. And I'd like you to come out and speak to them sometime, because, you know, you are the personification of the message that, you know, your dream doesn't necessarily have to make sense to your high school guidance counselor. You know,
absolutely.
It's your dream.
There are so many different marginalized groups. Obviously, LGBT youth are a hugely affected population. They are disproportionately more likely to commit suicide, to abuse drugs or other substances. I mean, it is an at-risk community. And they're
also most likely to be cut off from their natural support group.
Exactly. I know. Families disown children all the time.
And also, it's not only just being disowned, but also you have to remember a lot of them come from highly dysfunctional families anyway. It has nothing even to do with approval or disapproval. It's just mom might be in jail, there may not be a dad, and, you know, if you fall through the cracks, oftentimes you land on the street.
That is true.
Well, you are listening to So What's Your Story on 90.1 KPFT Houston, 89.5 in Galveston, and 91.9 for all of our friends in Huntsville. My guest storyteller is Derek Shore, host of KPRC's Houston Life, an all-around interesting guy. We are missing Miss Nicole Rocherlin tonight, but she's becoming a star in her own right, and we couldn't be more proud of her. I don't know exactly what she's doing tonight, but I'm guessing she is hosting, emceeing, or performing at some very cool event, because that is what Nicole does these days. However, we are most fortunate to have the hardest working intern in the business behind the controls tonight. Miss Tatiana Gago is in the house.
All right.
How are you doing this week, Tatiana?
Oh, you're so close.
I know. I've been so good for several weeks now.
No, I've been good. Very busy this week. A lot of work that I've procrastinated on.
You?
So I have my days.
I've never seen you procrastinate. As you know, each and every week, the many storytelling events in Houston just continue to grow and inspire new storytellers, and I could not be more proud of the role this program plays in that. Tatiana, will you let folks know where they can hear some of the city's wonderful storytellers?
Of course, Greg. It's my pleasure. To start, everyone needs to follow us on Facebook, and please share our page with your friends and click like on our page so everyone knows that you really like us. We have program clips on YouTube and all our past So What's Your Story programs on the Houston Storytellers website at www.houstonstorytellers.org. Just go to the radio program link on their site and enjoy. The Guild is also our proud sponsor. Their swaps meet the fourth Tuesday of every month at Temple Emanuel at 1500 Sunset. Also, don't miss our friends at The Moth at Warehouse Live the second Tuesday of every month.
Thanks, Tatiana. This is Greg Audell, and you're listening to So What's Your Story? With my in-studio guest, Derek Shore, co-host of Channel 2's Houston Life, on each and every weekday at 1 p.m. Central Time. Next week, the master himself, Dr. Hank Rubicek, will be hosting J.J. Simmons, a returning guest, and three of her girls from her Center for Abused Children. They will be sharing original essays about how they have grown thanks to J.J.'s Girls, the nonprofit she started. That should be one very, very good show. J.J.'s always, always worth listening to. One of the goals of this program is to encourage folks to find their own voice as a storyteller. We do that with a segment called Tips for the Teller. Author Naomi Chibana has taken a close look at the common elements of the most successful TED Talks. The most commonly overlooked element by those new to storytelling is the ability to create suspense. You know, those who love to watch movies or read books know that a good story always must have conflict and a plot. These two elements are what makes a good presentation into the roller coaster ride that becomes, and keeps listeners and viewers at the edge of their seats asking themselves, well, what's going to happen next? You know, so you don't want to paint it all out to them. One way is to begin by telling a predictable story and then surprising the audience by taking a completely different turn from what was expected. I try to do this in every single talk I give. If you get the audience comfortable of their certainty of where the story is going, and then you totally change directions on them, I guarantee you're going to have their full attention. Now, Derek, you know, since you are a storyteller each and every day, what suggestions would you give someone trying to improve their storytelling skills or increase their confidence?
You know, that's a great question, Greg. First and foremost, I see this all the time. If you are a storyteller, this happens, oh my gosh, it happens so frequently. The story is not about you. The story is not about the reporter. And honestly, I think once young journalists or storytellers, writers, authors, whatever, figure that out, then things sort of magically fall into place. Sometimes a natural curiosity may not just sort of happen instinctually, mm-hmm. but honestly, I think the best storytellers are people who are naturally curious. I meet people all the time who can talk on and on and on. You know, they're sort of on transmit only.
They're, I like that.
And it is, I mean, that's exhausting. And I think the best storytellers, even though you are telling a story, you can't tell a good story until you learn how to listen. Listen, act like a sponge, absorb what's going on around you. Because honestly, we're all dynamic, different folks. That's great. But at the end of the day, you know, I've lived my my life. I don't need to talk. I know on the radio show, the irony of tonight is that we're talking about my career. But in general, I actually really don't like talking about myself. I would much rather learn about someone else because that is what sort of gets me going. So I would say, listen, number one, and number two, the story is about the subject. It's not about the storyteller.
Very, very good tips. I'm telling you, folks, if you keep listening to our tips for the teller and you just get a little more confidence and go out there one time, you're going to find your voice as a storyteller. I promise you
for
that.
For sure.
I certainly did. As many of you know, I had 30 minutes warning before the first time I went on that Moth stage, and they drew my name very first. I had never been to a Moth performance.
That's awesome.
And, you know, I think if I'd had a little more time to freak out, I might not have done it. Derek, after traveling the world, living a glamorous life, did you ever guess that you'd end up working at a shopping mall in Houston, Texas?
Oh, my gosh. Well, okay, first of all, the glamorous life. Yeah, it is fun to look back at these highlight clips of me interviewing people on the red carpet and stuff, but traveling the world is a schlep. It is hard work.
I bet it is.
Yeah, it is. And oftentimes, I remember I was going to college at the same time I was working for Channel One News, and I would take a red eye flight to DC. I'd land, you know, early in the morning. I'd go to the White House. I'd report for the day. I'd jump on a plane. I'd fly back to LA. I'd go back to school the next morning. There's the glamorous part of the job. Honestly, there have been maybe several little moments of glamour. Last summer when I was with my mom on the red carpet at the Emmys and I was actually a nominee, that's kind of glamorous.
That's pretty cool.
That is pretty cool. Those moments, though, holy cow, those are few and far between. Most of the time, it is a little bit of a schlep. And to answer your question, did I ever think I would end up at the mall? No, I certainly did not. I was working in Los Angeles. Most recently, my last job there was at the former PBS station. It's KCET, actually. I have their pen here tonight, coincidentally. KCET is the largest independent public television station in the country, and we do great stories. We did great stories when I was part of that team. I was doing stories about the drought in California, homelessness on Skid Row, everything under the sun you can think of, plastic bottle recycling, drones, the proliferation of drones and people having these near misses with airplanes. So I was doing work that essentially took me out into the community in Southern California. These were long form stories. So it was a weekly news magazine. It would air in prime time. And we had about 8, 9, 10 minutes to tell a story on the air, which for people who are familiar with TV, you rarely see a story that long on TV. Normally, you turn on the news and you see a story that's 90 seconds long, a minute and a half. So the show that I was doing, we really had time to sink our teeth into an issue and give people a comprehensive look at the issue, right? And I remember one day I was in the edit bay with my editor and we were putting a story together. And I had a brand new agent at the time. She called me. And she said, so Derek, good news and bad news. TLC, I was up for this TLC show that, you know, went up in flames. TLC, yeah, that show's not going to happen. They liked you as the host, but it's just not going to happen. Because remember, the thing about show business is, while the rest of the world is going to their job every day, in show business, you're always like, okay, what's next? Who else will hire me? Because you may have a great TV show one day, and then the next day, it's gone. Right. So you've always got to be out hustling. So my agent called and gave me the bad news about TLC, but then said, but there is this great affiliate. It's an NBC affiliate in Houston, Texas, KPRC. They want to meet with you. And I said, Tatiana, my agent, this is what Houston, this was not even on my, we had this conversation. I mean, I've lived in LA. This is not, I'm going to move to Texas and they're going to kill me. That was essentially, honestly, and this was my naivete. As open-minded as I thought I was, the idea of moving to Houston was just sort of scary in some ways. But I was also at a point in my career where I had done a lot of different things and I thought, you know what? Maybe I should give this a chance. Houston's a big city, and I've heard good things about it. I knew Anise Parker had been mayor, and that was sort of a beacon of hope for so many people. Remember when she was elected, it made international news?
Oh, yeah.
We certainly heard about it in L.A. So I thought, okay, well, they had a lesbian mayor, and they didn't kill her. So maybe I should go down here. So I jumped on a little Southwest flight, and I flew down to Channel 2 off Southwest Freeway there. And I met these people who worked there, and I thought, wow, these people are actually really nice and really cool, and it's kind of fun. So it was 2 days of screen testing, and you know, it's very intense. We mixed and matched with different host candidates. So they had brought a handful of us in from different cities around the country. They had spent months looking for hosts here in Houston. They decided they sort of wanted to bring in outside talent so they could experience Houston with fresh eyes, Houston life, you know, checking out the city from a new person's perspective. And ultimately, they made me an offer, and I ended up signing a deal. I wrapped up my show in LA. We were wrapping up the season of our news magazine in late June. And I think I had about 2 days off, and I moved from LA to Houston. I essentially just locked the door to my place in LA, which I later sold, but I didn't have time to pack or anything. And I jumped on a plane and I came down here and I checked into the Extended Stay America at the Galleria. It's a very glamorous hotel. And suddenly it was like, okay, you're here. It's July. The show is launching in August. And the whole idea of the mall was something that intrigued me, but also seemed a little bit silly in some ways. And if you watch the show, if any of you listening out there have seen our show, Houston Life, you hear me say very frequently, welcome to our little show at the mall. I mean, we don't take ourselves that seriously. And I've joked that I want business cards that say, you know, mall host or host, comma, shopping mall. It's bizarre. I mean, my job is it's a weird job. I host a TV show in a mall. And there's some days when I'm like, holy cow, I host a show in a mall. And then there are other days I'm like, I host a show in a mall. Nice to meet you. So we have a lot of fun, and it is unconventional. And I think that that's one of the reasons why it makes it great. So that's sort of how it all happened coming to Houston. But now, fast forward, it's been almost 2 years, and I am a proud Houstonian. I love this city. I bought a house. I'm settling in. The cost of living here is so much more reasonable. It's actually really cool. There's so much great stuff going on in the city, and I feel like I'm here for a reason.
As long as you get here as fast as you possibly can, then we can consider you a native.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Perfect. Then I'm a native.
Well, that's great. And why did they decide to do it in a shopping mall?
I think they wanted something that was different. I mean, the fact that I'm the host of the show is also an indication that they wanted something different. Because I remember meeting with all the executives at Channel 2 at KPRC, Gay PRC, which I later learned people like to call it. I remember thinking, holy cow, do they know I'm gay? Like, they haven't asked me that question in the interview. You know what did concern me, though? Texas is still a state where you can be fired from your job for being gay.
Yeah.
And that was actually really scary to me, because I thought, what if I move there and it doesn't work out and they just decide to say, oh, we're firing you because you're gay? Obviously, that was because I knew nothing about Channel 2. KPRC is the most amazing, fair, equality-loving station. We have such a diverse staff. I am so proud of all TV stations in town. No offense to any of the others.
No, I got to tell you, I grew up, loving the local TV shows, whether it was Warner Roberts, Nancy Ames. When I had surgery when I was 11, my mother arranged what would be the most exciting thing for a geek like me. She got me a tour of Channel 11. I got to sit on set while they did the news.
That's awesome.
And I was fascinated by everything that went
magical.
On. And she also raised me going to all the great little kids shows in Houston, whether it was No-No the Clown. And I want to take a chance to tip my hat to Frank Average, who was the original Bozo the Clown. He passed away this week at 89 years old.
Wow.
He played Bozo from 1959 to 1970. And he was primarily in Boston. What a lot of people don't know about Bozo is it was a franchise operation. So every city had their own Bozo. So there were lots of Bozos, but he was the original Bozo.
I did not realize that.
He was. And, fortunately, when I was 5 years old, my mother allowed me to make my first media appearance on Bozo the Clown. And I got picked to participate in this contest. And the prize was this amazing car set like I have never seen before. And what you had to do, there were about 10 kids and there were balloons everywhere. And whatever kid picked up the most balloons and crossed the finish line first won the car set. I remember this perfectly. It was a great life lesson. I saw these kids with 3 and 4 balloons. I thought, What idiots. They don't want it. I crossed the line with 21 balloons and had that set forever. And I just remembered thinking, okay, so if you want it more, you just have to work a little bit harder than the next kid.
How did you hold 21 balloons?
It was my mother has a picture of it, but
because I wanted that crevice, car seat. Under your arms, between your legs, around your neck.
I did all of those. It was like this. Well, I'm sorry, you can't see on radio, and we're not Facebook Live tonight.
That's impressive.
I just think the local productions added so much to a community, you know. And longtime Houstonians will remember the Donna, Donna Claire and Jim Mahoney. Show for little kids on Channel 26 that was a talent show. Jim Mahoney and Gina Claire, that's what it was. And I think there was a time when we weren't doing many productions of local shows. It seemed to be out of phase, and it seems like they've been coming back in recent years. You know, you don't just pay to have, you know, your little membership in a national show.
Yeah.
You know, and it makes a real difference to knowing what is going on in the heartbeat of the community.
Yeah. Houston Life, we took the spot that Meredith Vieira, that show was occupying on Channel 2.
Exactly.
Yeah, and I'm so glad that Channel 2 did it because it is, I feel like this city needs a show like this. And the national shows, there's a lot of great content on the networks for sure, but there's nothing like local storytelling. And we talked at the top of this hour about the relatability and viewers and listeners being able to identify with what they're seeing on TV and hearing on the radio. Local programming, honestly, that is so many local programs we've lost.
Well, and that's what I'm proud of about our show. You know, we welcome storytellers from anywhere, and we do occasionally have traveling storytellers come in, and that's great. But I would say 95% of our storytellers are Houston-based. And those are the stories that I really relish telling when I get to learn about corners of our community that I didn't know about before. And it might be a place I've driven by 1,000 times in my life.
Yeah.
You know, but we get the right person in to tell the right story, and our listeners get to experience Houston in a way they never would if they were listening to Larry King Live.
That's a good point. It's true.
Now, you've accomplished so much, and you probably hate this question, but as you say, of course, you're always thinking about next horizons. What goals do you have on your bucket list that you still want to accomplish?
It is a great question. When I first came to Houston, I remember thinking, okay, it's a 3-year contract. I can do this, even if it's awful and people are, you know, threatening to kill me, which they haven't done. Not yet, anyway. I sort of saw it as a stopover. I could see myself staying in Houston for a long time. Part of that is Brandon, because Brandon, my boyfriend, he works for the Manil Collection, and he's very involved in the community here. And it's just such a dynamic city. It's not – the humidity in Houston, a lot of us are not fans of it in the summer. But other than that, there is so much great stuff in this city, culturally, politically, the medical community, the universities here. This city offers, I really believe, something for everyone.
If people think Houston is boring, I always tell them, let me show you my Houston.
Exactly.
Let me show you my Houston.
Exactly. And it's a very dynamic city. Not a lot of big cities can say that. I think L.A. is a dynamic city, and Chicago, New York, you know, we are all like in the top 10. Houston is one of the best-kept secrets. I think it is totally underrated. Part of me doesn't want everyone to know about Houston because it is a comfortable, besides the traffic and the weather, it's a comfortable, great place to live with a low cost of, you know, housing and all that. But ultimately, Greg, I don't know. It's a tricky answer. We don't have a crystal ball. I would love to do what I'm doing on a larger scale. As long as I'm continuing to tell stories, I think I will be satisfied. Some of the issues, some of these national TV shows and even news networks, you turn on the TV and it's, have you ever heard the term pack journalism, where like every network is covering the same story? It's like, oh, you're covering the same White House briefing. That's not interesting. Oh, you're covering the same feel-good weather story. Not interesting.
The same script, it seems like.
Oh, my gosh.
And even the late-night comedy shows are guilty of that.
Yeah, many times you can flip channels and not see a lot of, you know, dynamic programming. So I don't want to be so far entrenched into any sort of television production machine that the fun is lost. And one of the things I love about KPRC Channel 2 and the show that we do, Houston Life, is that we're an hour show. We're live, and most of that time is completely unscripted.
I noticed that when I was there.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure it would work if it was scripted, because y'all have to move so fast.
We move very quickly. There are scripted intros where we might, you know, read the teleprompter for a couple sentences, but then Courtney and I are off to the races every single day. So
you're a good team.
Thank you very much. We have such a good time. Courtney's great. And I don't know. I have a hard time imagining another job out there at this point in time that would top what we're doing now. Yes, we're a local show in the fourth largest city in America. And yes, we're at a shopping mall. And we still have growing pains and issues because we've only been on the air for a year and a half. But it is so much fun. And it's such an unusual, rare job that maybe it other points in my career, I was thinking about what's next, but right now I'm trying not to dwell on that too much.
It's interesting what you say, because a very wise friend of mine, when I started as co-host of this show, told me, you know, one of the most important things you can do is to have fun with every episode, whether it's serious, whether it's not serious. But if you're interested and if you're generally enjoying yourself, then the audience is going to enjoy itself too.
I totally agree. I totally agree. And whether we're teaching you how to DIY your Thanksgiving table setting, or, you know, repair a leaky faucet at home, or talk about spring fashion trends, every single day I'm like, holy cow, we have goats in the green room. We have a puppy out front. We have cocktails being mixed in the back hallway. And there are a bunch of models walking around. Like, this is my job.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's a pretty fun way to go through the day. Now, we did not discuss this question. If you have a 2-minute story, but I would not put you on the spot, but I heard you discuss it briefly on the air.
Sure.
One of my all-time least favorite celebrities is Bruce Willis.
Oh my gosh.
And you've alluded to it on the air, but you've never actually told the story. So I was wondering if you could tell it in about 4 minutes.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. So, Bruce Willis, dear Bruce, I hope you're listening to this. Why are you so nasty? Why are you so mean? Bruce was in this movie called Red, Retired Extremely Dangerous. His co-star was Helen Mirren in the film. And over the course of my career, like when I think back of the huge A-listers, I interviewed Hilary Swank at the Oscars the night she won Best Actress for Boys Don't Cry. Alanis Morissette and I co-hosted a show together once, and she was just lovely. When I say that most of these A-listers I've dealt... Oh, Laura Bush, when she was First Lady and I interviewed her. Laura Bush is amazing. Laura Bush is the nicest person. The Bush family, they're so nice.
She was extremely kind to me when I was a little kid.
Isn't she incredible?
Yeah.
I mean, and gracious, lovely, classy. I adore her. So for the most part, that is my experience across the board. You meet these massive celebrities, Kurt Russell. I mean, I've interviewed, living in LA as long as I did, I interviewed a lot of celebrities. Few of them, actually none of them, left an impression the way Bruce Willis did. It was so Retired Extremely Dangerous, this movie he did with Helen Mirren. I was co-hosting, CBS does this Comic-Con special. Comic-Con is, of course, the comic convention that happens down in San Diego, California. It has gotten huge over the years. I don't know what the attendance is now, but I think it's a few million. In fact, the convention center, it's outgrown the convention center. They're building a new one. So Bruce Willis was down there doing press and publicity for this film. And I interviewed him on the red carpet when I was working for CBS, hosting the show for them. And the reporter before me asked him if he followed Ashton, as in Kutcher, on Twitter. They're like, so Bruce, you follow Ashton Kutcher on Twitter? You know, I think the reporter thought they were being cute. At the time, of course, Demi Moore was married to Ashton Kutcher. He's now married to Mila Kunis, or dating at least. I think they have a baby. But, you know, I think that just made Bruce a little sour, made him kind of mad. And it's kind of intimidating when a star like Bruce Willis comes up to you on the red carpet and you have to come up with questions. And he just was not nice. That's all I can say. I mean, any question I asked, I was like, so what's it like coming to Comic-Con and you've got all of these people clamming for your attention? And he looked at me deadpan and said, what people? What are you talking about? I think he thought my questions were too generic, and granted, I was nervous and maybe a bit inexperienced.
Was this on live TV?
It wasn't on live TV. It was taped. But it still was just not... I think he sensed the fact that I was a nervous reporter. And instead of being cool and helping me along with it and like, oh, hey, cool, and playing ball.
He went in for the kill?
He went in for the kill and just acted like a complete asshat. There have been times when roles have been reversed and I've been interviewed by a nervous reporter on the red carpet.
Yeah.
And holy cow, I am nothing but nice and understanding.
It's like former waiters make the best waiters.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Well, you've cleared it up and cemented my view of Bruce Willis.
Yeah, you know what? It's I'm sorry to tell you the news, but not a fan.
Well, I'll tell you what, since you mentioned Laura Bush, mm-hmm. I'd like to tip my hat to both Laura Bush and former President Jimmy Carter, who, as many listeners of this program know, was very, very kind to me when I was a child. And it was actually 35 years ago yesterday that the President of the United States called a little kid who'd been trying to reach him. And if you want to read about it, you can just Google Jimmy Carter and the Kid on the Bar Stool in the Houston Chronicle by Andrea White. And that led a few months later to me being in the Bush's suite the night Daddy Bush was elected vice president.
No way.
And I was crying, and Laura Bush came up to me and said, "What's wrong?" I was 13, I think. And I said, "Jimmy Carter's a friend of mine." And she gave me a hug, and she said, "You know, when I married into this family, I was a Democrat. And if you stay in politics, your team's going to win again." She goes, "Tonight wasn't your night, but your team will win again." I'm a hardcore Democrat, and I think she was the classiest, kindest, sweetest woman I've ever met, that she would be so kind in that moment to talk to a kid who was crying because her father-in-law had just become vice president of the United States of America.
Wow.
And
grace and classic style.
Absolutely. And the same goes for President Carter, who didn't need to be nice to a kid or take time out of his day, but he did. And certainly changed the direction of my life, knowing that the President of the United States was curious about what was going on with me.
I am sure it did. I'm going to read about this story, Greg, because that's really, really cool. And
well,
President Carter, also a class act.
Class act. Well, Derek Shore, thank you for being my guest this evening and for all the interesting parts of Houston that you introduce us to each and every weekday at 1 p.m. on KPRC's Houston Life. Wild Bill and the Vinyl Avengers are up next. Make great radio a part of every day. And while you're driving home, need a break from the long day, turn in for the night, or just chilling out like Floyd here, join us each and every Wednesday at 8 p.m. for So What's Your Story? Treasure what you hear. You keep loving a great story, and we will keep bringing them to you. Above all, be good to each other. Tip well whenever the opportunity presents itself. The entire So What's Your Story team and I will always be searching for the next great story, and we will forever be reminding you that it is never too late to live happily ever after, my friends. Good night.
Start your engines. Houston is revving up for the 31st annual Houston Art Car Parade Weekend. Mark your calendars and enjoy four fun-filled days of festivities from April 12th to April 15th. Get into the mood with 2 days of pre-parade partying including a sensational sneak peek soiree and the legendary Art Car Ball. Then, the weekend's main event, the one and only Art Car Parade, Saturday, April 14th. Tickets, VIP passes, and more details at thehoustonartcarparade.com. Powered by the Orange Show Center for Visionary Art and KPFT Houston.